Brother, you are trying to make a positive difference. You're trying to close an achievement gap. Why the hell are you getting death threats, man? Why the hell are people harassing you for doing the right thing?
I am Ron Whitmore with Loris Bell, and we are Evanston Rules. It is often said that if a person won't stand for something, they will fall for anything. We are happy to introduce you to the superintendent of School District 65, Dr. Devon Horton, who has been standing for a long time, and more importantly, he has been unafraid to do so. Dr. Horton shares his experiences growing up in the inner city and how he had to navigate the projects. He opens up about his adjustment in a military high school and how, through that experience, he found his love for learning. And he opens up about his journey to District 65.
Good afternoon, Dr. Horton. We are so pleased to have you on Evanston Rules. We both came up through District 65. We're Dewey kids.
Oh, okay.
And Nichols kids.
And Nichols kids.
And Evanston Township kids.
Right? And we were in first grade in 1968.
Okay.
So knowing the history of Evanston schools and what was going on then, the class before us was the first class with desegregation, right?
I'm going to call it the hook. It was
yes,
the first class of the American lie. It was the first class of experiments that were designed to destroy Black people. Charles Ogletree talks about it in his book, All Deliberate Speed, right?
Yes.
No clear design around integration. And although we're old enough to say we made it, I don't know if we made it. Did we make it?
Well, we always make it. We always make it, except that we don't always make it.
Right.
We talk about how strong we are, and we are strong. We are superheroes, but we shouldn't have to be.
Yes.
And what I think we see is that 55 years later, you're facing a whole lot of issues to fix a whole lot of things that people thought they were fixing then. How do you handle it all?
So I think there's no better time than to use this phrase. There's method to the madness, right? There's a process, like when you think about walking into a community like Evanston, any school district for that matter, that you can all read the tea leaves, right? Mm-hmm. There are outcomes on one end, and you're like, wow, what? Why does this data look this way? And then there's the whole public-facing piece that we believe in equity and equality and Black Lives Matter and our LGBTQ flags flying high. I understand that there, like right away, there are some fallacies and some disconnects. And so what you find in our community, unfortunately, are some really nice people. I hear that every time. Some of the nicest people you'll meet. This is a nice town. But how many people go beyond the niceness? It's concerning at times. For me as a leader, I learned this term with one of our speakers we had here back in October, when we talk about the benevolent oppressors, and you want to tell people how fast you can go, how high you can jump, what methods they're comfortable with using to address these inequities. And zero sum game is like a thing, right, in many communities when you talk about this diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And so coming from looking at what the data says, and then for every single outcome, there is a, to your specific question, there is a cause and effect, right? Mm-hmm. So if the reading gap is there, you have to track that all the way down to when we look at our curriculum, or do we have culture responsive practices from what's written, what's taught, and what's assessed? Yeah, we may have these great written curriculums, potentially, right? That may happen. But have we assessed it properly? Are we assessing it within a research-based time frame so that we can get data right back? And then when we talk about what's taught, have we adopted practices, right, that go along with the needs of our students? And so do we spend enough time there? Who do you have in front of you? And I'm going to end with this. What do your policies say? Mm. Who are the people you have? And what are your practices that you're delivering? And that's what you prioritize in that order, right? Policy, people, practice.
Dr. Horton, I want to unpack this nice Evanston, this comfortable Evanston. Liars use data, but data never lies, right?
Yes.
And as I couch that with nice Evanston, Evanston has a history of being comfortable with the data, but not comfortable with what the data says. Mm-hmm. And it clearly says that before your administration, and the administration before and the administration before, there has been a consistent downward spiral in the achievement of Black students.
Yes.
We know that there has been an exodus of Black people in Evanston. When Laurice and I were growing up, it was 40-some% Black people in Evanston. And now in Evanston, we're down to 16%. And you're right. We're waving the Black Lives Matter flags. We're waving the I got Black friends rhetoric. We're ranting and raving about this whole notion of equity and fairness. But I come from a school where I too thought Evanston was this golden place that everybody got along until some of my best white friends used the N-word in jokes when they came back from college. And I convinced them very quickly that I was who they thought I was. Brother, you are trying to make a positive difference. You're trying to close an achievement gap.
Yep.
Why the hell are you getting death threats, man? Yep. Why the hell are people harassing you for doing the right thing?
Well, here's the thing. I really believe many people see this DEIB work. It's not about the work itself. It's not about change. It's about what are they going to lose? And so within that, right, there are a lot of people that are eating great on things that haven't been necessarily earned, right? Or, yeah, you're eating great, but others didn't have the same opportunity. And we talk about this achievement gap that you just mentioned. We all know when you unpack that, there are some other elements of this achievement gap, right? First, there has been an opportunity gap that existed more than anything, right? Do we have the same access? Do we have the same resources? You mentioned the desegregation movement. Brown versus Board of Education, in theory, was the right way to go, but its implementation was wrong.
Exactly.
So to take the resources, the goal was to take resources and put them equitably in schools, not take the children and put them in a community that have the resources. So now you get a Fifth Ward without a school, right? And that this is not unique. There are some situations that are worse than what happened in the Fifth Ward. And that's terrible, the whole setup, right? But it's happening across the country. So that's the opportunity gap, right? Then there's the opportunity to go to school in your neighborhood, right?
Mm.
Opportunity to have Black and brown educators like in front of you, right? The opportunity to be taught curriculum that's relevant to your history, right? All of that.
That's true.
And then there's the expectation gap. You must have your policies in line. So that means getting our Fifth Ward school, putting DEIB at the center, building a formality where white supremacy and racism is not accepted, right? That's around policy. The next order of business is getting teachers. So when we talk about an expectation gap, when you don't have anti-racist educators sitting in front of your students, and this is for all, anti-racist meaning you believe in the person that's sitting there and you're going to give them the resources and you have these higher expectations, then you're open to giving the opportunities to be in honors classes, AP classes, opportunities to be in these advanced programs and resources, right? But more than all of that, when you speak about this work and why am I getting death threats, is because empathy for us and for my board
church
has been like a calling. We don't want sympathy.
No.
We want to lead and position our students and our staff through empathy. And empathy causes us to put ourselves, Black, white, brown, yellow, in the same shoes as the students that we serve. And people are, some not many, because it's a small but loud group. Real talk. This is why you get death threats, because we are now making people uncomfortable. We've been uncomfortable our entire lives. Not everybody else has. Right? Get comfortable being uncomfortable is a movement here in 65.
One, courageous is as courageous does. So thank you for being courageous. Dr. Horton, what planet did you come from, brother? How did you get to be who you are?
Oh, man, how long I got? You know, when I came on board, I told the community, my staff, we have an amazing staff. I introduced them to me, and I had to talk about my upbringing. I grew up in Robert Taylor Housing Projects, south side of Chicago. And my best way to describe it to people that's not from Chicago, when you were riding down the Dan Ryan in the 80s and the 90s, and you saw White Sox Park on the left side, and them red and white buildings on that other, that was me. And I grew up in a pandemic, right? But the pandemic wasn't COVID. The pandemic was, and I didn't know this at the time, was redlining. This, Robert Taylor's a slum. It's basically a slum community, a slum village. It was space, right? One of the first city planners in the country was a guy by the last name of Bartholomew out of Louisville. And he would take valuable space, and instead of just letting it sit there, would throw up these temporary housing places.
Barracks.
Yes, barracks. And so Blacks, because they were so affordable, right? We would move in. My mom was, she grew up in one set of projects. And when we came along, she moved me to another. So it was drugs, it was killing, it was robbing. And I swear I grew up thinking, man, why are people got to be like this? They don't want better. I grew up thinking that, right? Thinking that the gangs are people choosing to just be bad and be villains. What I learned, though, as I got older, is that those designs were intentional.
Mm.
And when you put a million people, like my building was 16 stories with 10 apartments on each floor, and it was 29 buildings in a row. When you put them in the same place.
Elevators.
Exactly. That is a pandemic. At the time, people were dying because of the culture of those communities. So I started to learn about that whole design around how to survive, right? Once I became educated, and my mom was brilliant, like 10th grade education, didn't have a dad, three sisters, four of us growing up in Robert Taylor housing, I was more fearful of her than the gangs, than the dope, anything. And I was more fearful of her because I was going to have to see her every night and every morning. And she made sure she don't care how fast I run, how high I jump. She didn't care about any of it. She says, you're going to read, do math, and school is going to be your way. Hey, I had the opportunity. I think that was my privilege, right? I had a mom that was really locked in on us. And I fast forward to now. Three of us are educators. One is in Memphis. My sister's in CPS. I have another sister that's a chef out in LA, right? So she did some amazing work. And so when we talk about like what the planet I come from, man, I come from Robert Taylor, man. Like this here is a different world. And so when we talk about the fears of physical abuse or our famous keyboard warriors or our FOIA warriors to try to make these things up, I use the system the way you need to, but I'm not concerned because we are doing the work the right way. Is it perfect? Is it right where it needs to be? No, but we're continuing to work towards that. And so I learned you can't be fearful if you're on a journey, you know, to righteousness. And that's what we're doing here in 65.
I hear you talk about your mom, the strength of your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And when parents are involved, whether you have no money, a lot of money, when parents are involved in the right way, it's a good thing for kids. But without the involvement of a parent, it is very difficult, especially mm-hmm. in grade school.
Absolutely.
Colonizers think and react only the way they can react. Dr. Horton, you, Lorice, you, I, we've all seen people that have been brilliant without involved parents that have made it.
Yep.
Doc, you mentioned very clearly that equity is about their reaction to the people that they see sitting in front of them. Entitlement, institutional racism, helps those believe that I know better based on who I am and who my privilege is.
Yep.
So I can judge what kind of house you have and what you have not.
Yes.
The reality is, and Lorice and I talk about this all the time, and you said it is, we have got to see whoever is in front of us.
Yes.
We have to see that child and believe that child has magic in spite of what they have, where they come from, or how many parents they have.
Yes.
Because the reality is, we used to always say, if I believe, I can achieve. Mm. If you believe, they will achieve.
Yes. Can I add to that too?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. Really quickly, I didn't say this, but I can just name them. Miss Campbell, Miss Vaughn, Miss Jackson, Miss Duke, Miss Gibson, Miss Quintus for 3 years, and Miss Allen. Those were my teachers, K-8. I went to K-8 school. But when parents were not involved, I can't say my mom was always like Johnny on the spot, but those teachers made sure she was involved. Right. That's what's really critical. Like it was nothing going on in the school that my teachers would not communicate with my mom. We didn't have a house phone. We didn't have a phone. But I guarantee you they made sure sending notes in the book bags or whatever it may be. They was communicating with my mom, good or bad. For those who don't have the involved parents, if you have that policy, people piece in order, they'll do the outreach and they'll do the work that's necessary to reach your students.
You know, people still have hopes and dreams.
Yes.
And you have a lot, you have a little. You're representing all of your students and you want to make sure everybody has the opportunity. So we're talking about equity. We're talking about opportunities in education so that people can not be looked at sideways by the time they get to high school when they want to plan for college. But getting there, even though it's really a few years, there's a lot that happens. How do you handle the hopes and dreams, and how do you keep them alive?
I love that. I love this question. You know, this is probably an area where I can say 65 and 202, we are really collaborating on. We're collaborating on some other things, but this is fairly new. It's called Portraits of a Graduate. What does that mean? We're on this call and we have our career paths and our families, not because how well we did reading, math, science, social studies, not about how fast we can run, how high we can jump. We did it because we have a set of skills, right, that are critical. Why aren't we, as a school system, we're learning to focus on teaching students about resiliency, teaching students about being culturally and globally aware, teaching students how to collaborate, right? Teaching students how to advocate for themselves. These are skills that we picked up somewhere along the way, because I can't look back until I got to high school, because I went to military high school, where that's where those skills were like clearly pulled out and I was taught and trained in them. Most school systems don't do that. And so we're on this journey here in 65 and 202 as well. I can't speak all the way for them, but I know they're definitely on this journey as well in this specific area where we want to be intentional about those things. So when you have students who don't have the family support or maybe lacking some of those other things, right? The reading skills, right? You may not be a dynamic reader in third grade, but are we working with them to build the capacity to get up from that and be able to put the efforts in to learn how to deal with the resiliency, right? Along with the resources. So when we talk about opportunity, when we see students in third grade, I'm gonna talk about the district prior, we were giving them like reading teachers. Sounds good, right? But when we looked at the data, right? I came in and this data was shared with me. We had students who were going through our reading program, reading intervention program, that were being outperformed by students who were just getting regular reading classes that needed the services. That was a disconnect somewhere. So what we have done now is that we've built these academic skill centers. And yes, we teach and support around literacy and numeracy, but we also focus on those executive functioning skills, right? Because once you learn how to read and how to do math, how do you maintain it and continue to elevate? You have to know how to note take. You have to know how to study, and you have to be organized for that. So we've made a commitment in our district. We have ASCs, Academic Skill Centers, where our students that are tier two are receiving those supports. We're hiring people from Northwestern, local, retired, not certified, but our data from these students, when they take the same assessment that our students that are not in it, it is outperforming them because we're giving them opportunity. We have an expectation that they can achieve. So, Maurice, you are on point. Like, what do you do?
Yep.
Right. Put yourself in their shoes and say, oh, what would I need if I was that student who was struggling with reading and I'm in sixth grade? Or I'm doing okay, but I'm barely getting by. What would I do for them? What would I want people to do for me? So we are creating these structures and we're creating these opportunities. Achievement gaps are outcomes, period. Opportunity, expectation, and empathy is what really drives the decision and the shifts on how we provide them what they need.
So you grew up on the South Side. We keep coming back to the South Side. You had a desire to teach. How did you find the opportunities?
Yeah, I love it. This is a true story. So my eighth grade year, you know, I was really solid K through eight, but solid for a hood school. I was the valedictorian coming out of a hood school, just to put it into perspective. But my teachers and my principals, here's what happened. There was a gentleman who came to our school to see if any of our students, because they had a, being honest, they had a quota to fill at my high school, Culver Military Academy. It's a boarding school in Indiana. And they were trying to see if we had anyone interested in taking a test to get in. And if we did well enough, you can get a scholarship. Me and four of the students took the assessment. Two of us did well. The other one decided not to go. And my counselor met with my mom because she wasn't going to let me go away. And they convinced her, like, this is the best move. So it goes back to, who do you have in that people place that will care enough to get in your business and say, you're making a bad decision by not letting him go to this boarding school? Convinced her, and I was off to Cobra Military Academy, and it changed my life.
For us woke Black and white liberals, what's a hood school?
100% minority, right? And the community is surrounded by crime, drugs, violence, gangs. That's what I'm describing. That's a lot of schools here in our country. And I'm gonna be honest, that's my jam. Like, my whole career has been working in those communities until I was fortunate enough and blessed enough to come here and lead Evanston. Like, that's been my calling.
You off to this military school. What next? Where did you go after high school?
So I went to Jackson State. My older sister was the first one in my family to graduate from college, went to Rust College in Mississippi, and she convinced me that it was so fun down there. I wasn't going to Rust. I wanted to go to Mississippi to go to school, and so I did that. And then I brought my sister right under me down to Jackson State with me as well. And so she and I both majored in teaching together.
And look what the HBCUs turned out.
Yes, sir.
At that time, when you made a decision to go to Jackson State, what was the response?
Oh, that's a good one. So I had some people that I was really cool with, some white classmates. And I remember this like yesterday. It was a young man who played hockey. I was in Battery C. He was in Battery B. He came up there to try to hoop in the afternoon after the season was over with me. And he asked me, he said, hey, you're not going to one of those all-Black schools, are you? Because one of my other classmates was going to Morehouse. It was three of us. It's really funny to hear that now, and I'm looking back. Three of us from my class in 95, two went to Morehouse, and I went to Jackson State. We went to HBCUs. And I said, absolutely. Why do you ask? He said, aren't those schools, he said something about, aren't those schools, like, basically, without saying it, like, second class? And I told him, I said, hey, I can name some people that came through Jackson State that's doing well on both sides, academics as well as athletics, but it's a good fit for me. And that was the end of the conversation. You know, it was my counselor didn't blink at it. Like, I got accepted into Drake University. So glad I didn't go there.
Right.
Rust College, Jackson State, Dayton, Ohio. I got into all four, but I knew where I needed to go.
But isn't it great that you had the self-reflection, knowing mm-hmm. who you were and what you needed?
Yes. Yes.
And we've often been told that our spaces, if they're ours, they're not interesting. They're not worthwhile. They're not going to take people where they need to be. And it's actually the exact opposite.
Opposite, yeah.
So with this Fifth Ward School, tell us what your plans are, what your hope is, and how you see it moving forward.
We have a chance to build, to be honest, we have not built a traditional school in this district, in this community, since 1971. Right. If my math is right, that's 52 years ago.
Right.
So the Fifth Ward School, what it does for us and for the children of Evanston as a whole, is going to generate more funds in the long run. The district will now be recouping, we'll say, $3.2 million a year because there's no busing. And then there will be no cost for the building. That's amazing to say that 20 years from now, the district is going to have a plus $3.2 million. In 20 years from now, you can imagine what it would cost to bus students. If that $3.2 million is the cost now for the Fifth Ward, right? It'll be $7-8 million a year. Now the district won't have to worry about it because the busing will be gone, right? That's one. On the sustainability side, we know putting kids on these buses with the fumes that's in the air is impacting so many things, right? What COVID has done, it has really opened up like the true reality of how students can learn and what happens with the airflow in buildings, all of this, right? And how it has a direct impact on student achievement. But it's happening in the Fifth Ward, right? And we're busing kids all over the city. So everyone will benefit from that, right? Now let's get to the adaptive side. Adaptively, what's going to happen is that this school becomes a hub of power, of love, of security for a community that's not had it in over 55 years. The other part is that we have an intentional focus of how we're going to place, you know, we're going to identify the teachers. I'm going back to that, the people, the right people to not only teach in that school, but to lead and connect. higher education, the way teachers have been created over the last forever, has been ineffective.
Yep.
Think about it. You get one university, you have 30 school districts, and they create the teacher that's gonna teach in all 30 of those schools. Let's be honest.
Cookie cutter.
Exactly. There's no cookie cutter work. So our teacher residency that we have, CREATE program, we're building the teachers that our students need. So 2 years from now, when this school opens up, we have at least 20 to 25 teachers that have been like built and trained for us by us, like FUBU, to be able to go into the fifth ward, right? Because we have an anti-racist focus on our teacher residency. So now you have teachers, you have leaders who believe, who have high expectations, and who are empathetic to the struggles of our children. And now the fifth ward is made up of Black and Brown, right? And so now we're going to have a teaching body that reflects that. We're going to have curriculum, right, that reflects that and that can connect. We'll have other services that are so unique, right, to this community that it will become the place to be in Evanston for schools. Right. If my math is right, that's 52 years ago.
Right.
Imagine being able to now have a one of the most dynamic, state-of-the-art built schools, not just in Evanston or Skokie, but in the North Shore.
As we've been hoping and talking and asking and screaming and writing and speaking and coming up with data that shows that we've needed this school for so long, what's happened is the community has changed and is changing. We see fewer of the folks that the school was initially being built for because there hasn't been a space for, let's just say it, Black families, Black students. When people talk to you about that, what is your response?
It's simple. So from our demographer study that we did last year, we're still going to have over 80% of the students that attend the school, if it opened in fall of 24, will be Black and Brown. 54% of them are Black students. So while it's no longer the same demographics that it was, that's pretty significant.
And that means it gives you a hub to show asset data about how effectively you can educate Black kids.
Yes.
How can the community help?
I think what at this stage where we are now, we need the community to be aware, listen, pay attention to what we're doing. We've been extremely transparent. We're the most transparent school district in North Shore. We have our monthly curriculum review reports where you can see when people are saying, you got all these staff members down in central office. You can go to the monthly curriculum review and read about every single one of them and what they've done for that month. And that's just the higher level of things that they've done. We also do it for our buildings and grounds. And when there's opportunity, right, to engage and social media becomes like a thing, reach out to us directly and get the real response. Don't let the social media take off and create any narrative that's not true. That's how the community can really help. Letting us know that, is the Fifth Ward community more concerned about green space in their foster field, or are they more interested in having a school where we reserve some of the green space, right? Those are technical things that the community really needs to speak up about. I think Evanston has some crazy number for parks per population. It's like the most in the country. Mm-hmm. So we take a space, we're going to really do some work for a community that has been deprived for so long. I think we can afford to make that shift.
Yeah. How do you, Dr. Horton, with all that you're dealing with, we mentioned the threats, the lawsuits, teachers up in arms about being held accountable, the microaggressions in Evanston, what do you do for your mental health and self-help?
Well, let me say this first. We have really built an amazing relationships with our teachers. So you may have seen it this year. We made a major shift to some workforce labor management. Maria Barroso and her DAC exec have been on point. Our board has been on point with that partnership. So I'm going to say that's really a key change from a year ago, right? But for me, I have a great wife who, when I walk through the door, she expects me to be the husband. She says all the time, she's the superintendent at home and the board, right? She's all of that. So she's like, look, we have children, younger children. I love my children. I'm fortunate to have my mom in the area now. And also my mother-in-law. So my family. Like, that's what really keeps me grounded. And I have some really cool friends that allows me to get away sometimes from just the day-to-day. But the other thing I'm going to say, I don't like to be away too much from this work because I love this. Like, I eat, sleep. This is my true passion, right? And when you find people that are doing the work that drive with passion, persistence, and powerful practices, yeah, that's some greatness on the horizon. So I'm passionate about this work. Yeah.
Is Evanston what you thought it was going to be?
No. Well, with a clear no. You know, again, when the facade and what you hear about the city and the community is one thing. I grew up always hearing about Evanston. I maybe ventured in a couple of times, but not much. It's a very nice place, but that niceness, it only goes so deep. There's an agenda that's being pushed. There's a population that lives in every community where there's any form of wealth that just have to be taken head on. And that's kind of what has happened here. So safe, yes, in a physical realm for the city I'm speaking of, but in the from the mental piece, I don't think it's all that safe for Black and brown families, not to the degree that it is for our white counterparts. And it's something that has to be worked on. Keep
on pushing. Not long after we conducted this interview, Dr. Horton made the decision to leave Evanston's District 65, and he accepted the superintendent position in Georgia's DeKalb County. Although Ron and I are sad to see him go, we are glad he shared his insights here with us on Evanston Rules. We're also grateful for the outpouring of support as we continue to have conversations that are honest about Evanston and the Evanston community. Evanston Rules can be found at evanstonrules.com, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and you can also find our past episodes on the Evanston Roundtable at evanstonroundtable.com. For Ron Whitmore, I'm Larice Bell. Thank you for listening. Listen to understand.